CliffCentral.com.
All right, good morning, CliffCentral.com. On a Monday, Leanne Mull and Sia Sangweni and you and I all here to make it through the week. And it is a five-day week, which is so annoying after you had 2 4-day weeks. Ugh, like what punishment? What did we do wrong? What did we do wrong to deserve a five-day week? Ugh.
Thanks, industrialism.
What did we do?
Yeah, thanks
what
so much.
What did we do wrong to have to work?
I know. It's outrageous, isn't it? And Sia and I are back on the...
Where are the trust funds, man?
Exactly. Why don't we have trust funds? So, listen, there's obviously quite a lot of news after the weekend that we still haven't got through. But I feel like we all need to do something. We need to, like, have a big event or something. I feel like it's time for everybody. Once we've got, and they say that it's going to take the next 10 months for us to all be vaccinated, or for enough of us to be vaccinated that we have herd immunity. If you've been through it already, you probably think this is, you know, it's too long to wait. Because England's opening up at the moment. The UK are very excited. They're opening pubs again. And for most people, that is all they care about, is like the opening of the
pubs. That's life.
I know.
Yes.
So I wonder when we will be able to say that we are fully opening up. And what we can do to celebrate that, like, should we do something fun together, or should we have a bunch of events around the country? What kinds of things can we start doing to just give ourselves permission to get back to normal life? I mean, what would you like to do?
I think we have to start off slowly.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be used to be open to being thrust into, like, a massive concert-type event yet. You know? Let's introduce ourselves slowly.
I'm okay with it. I don't really care if a place is very crowded. I went out, as I said to you, on Saturday night, and I was in one of these places in Joburg, and there was just such a throng of people. You know when you have to push your way through and you constantly feel like you're in a passage? I mean, I didn't last there very long because I didn't enjoy that before coronavirus.
Why? What's wrong?
It was just a lot of people. It was like at a bar. And you know, people were just pushing past each other, and it was just getting very, like, close. So I've never liked that before. I don't like it now. I didn't need to be there for extra long. I couldn't wait to get away, basically. So I know what you mean, Leanne, but at the same time, I don't really care about it's not because of the virus. I just don't like, you know, people standing on my feet the whole time.
The only big thing that's still missing in our lives are events of that level with tons and tons of people. But people are still making do, and they're making plans with things that they badly want to do that still aren't available. And mostly it's just like clubbing, because that is still not allowed under lockdown. I'll say allegedly, perhaps, maybe I heard by the grapevine that there are some clubs that are operational.
Oh, really?
A friend of mine and his squad in Cape Town went to a club.
Oh.
Maybe.
Okay.
I've been told, hypothetically.
All right.
Now, the screwed up thing is, what has happened is they actually caught the virus there as well.
Oh.
So I was sitting there like a smug old grandma going, what were you thinking in the first place? But the way they described it to me, it seemed like this high suspense action movie. They all had to meet at a particular location, and then a shuttle all picked them up, and then they couldn't even sit normally in the shuttle because, you know, then it's like, where are all of these people driving to? And then they had to, like, all lie down.
Oh, so
and
it was all very clandestine. It's like nobody's meant to know that they're doing this. Okay.
Very, very super, you know, undercover.
I don't think.
And then they're driven around the back to this club, and, you know, they demarcate times in which these shuttles can drive onto the property, and then you instantly, the gate is closed behind you, and you're brought to a different entrance. This is when I was like, oh, maybe I'd consider. Up until I heard this, they have to get in by midnight, and they can only leave by 4 because, that's curfew. I thought, nope, I can't commit to that. All 4 hours, you can't go outside. You can't go. Actually, an hour and a half was good for me. Now I need to go home. They couldn't. So people are still going crazy out here.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm in a hurry to get back to like, I've sort of fallen out of love with clubs and bars anyway. But I like the fact that everybody else should be allowed to, even if I don't. And you know, you can't say, well, if it's not something I like, then other people can't do it. The fact that you have to lie and you have to hide and you have to be all secretive about these things is not good. I think, you know, people have been having house parties throughout lockdown. I've had a few, and I'm sure you've been to a few. And, you know, people have seen the people they wanted to see anyway. And the fact that we've had to, like, lie and hide it from the police or anything else, it's just madness. One of my friends is driving around over the weekend, and he said it was dead, dead quiet. But he was on the highway at, like, 2 in the morning or whatever. And not a single cop in sight, not a single other car in sight. So people are taking chances, and you know, if you're caught outside a curfew, what are you going to do? You're just going to say to someone it's an emergency? I mean, what do you do to get out of that? I have no idea.
I've realized I've been forever changed though by this time, and also this regulation. I think maybe Leanne, you'd relate to this more than Gary. But you know, with so many rules in place and Big Brother's watching you and you must do this and you must do that, I get into a bit of a panic when I see cops now or JMPD. It's now like, yeah, what do you want from me? And it's still weird when I drive now. I still travel with my permit that I got at work last year this time. Don't ask me why. Don't ask me, you know, why they'd even call me out on it. I still do because I think I just want to make sure that I'm abiding by all of the rules. It's crazy.
Well, Chantel says she's still struggling to teach with a mask on, never mind having one on for hours. Yeah. And I think it's just so cruel that children have had to wear these masks because they don't – there is no evidence whatsoever that children have been affected adversely by this coronavirus and that they pass it on or anything else. So we've been punishing children unnecessarily for months now. And, you know, to grow up and to be at the age where you have to learn how to read people by their facial expressions, you have to be able to – you need to see if you're a kid whether someone's smiling at you or grimacing. And they haven't been able to do that.
No, because people tend to change between the two a lot when you're a child.
Correct. So good luck to you, Chantel. I mean, that's a tough thing to have to go through for teachers. And a lot of other people are complaining about how, you know, the trade shows and the conferences, et cetera, are not allowed yet. So that means, as Annette says here, that, you know, many people in that industry haven't worked since March last year. That's got to be really tough. Feel very sorry for people.
And, you know,
yeah.
Some people make their money through shows like that and whatnot. So it's tough for them. Sorry, going back to Chantal's point, but it's a bit of a tangent. I saw a few days ago, in my opinion, a ridiculous sight, but I guess they thought it was very sweet. It was a family of five, so three kids and the parents, all in matching fabric masks.
Oh.
So you can tell. That's
you can tell who belongs to who.
Yeah.
But you can tell, and I thought it just makes sense that it was from like some grandmother who just spent a lot of time thinking about her dear family and thought, let me make this for all of them.
I just want to go back to this curfew thing because I do not understand why we still need a curfew. Why is it necessary for people to have to be – and I know there are lots of people who said, oh, I love the curfew. It's a blessing because it means I don't have to stay out late or means I don't have to excuse myself. I can just use that as an excuse to get out of things that I don't want to be at. But really, that's just nonsense.
I think the argument is that it's still alcohol and alcohol-related. And the fact that the drunker people get, the more carefree they'll be – gathering in larger and larger groups and not giving a damn about social
distancing.
I'll
tell you what, I've noticed when I was in Mhlanga last weekend and any other time that I have been out, I didn't really see this on Saturday, but all people are doing is they're just drinking more in the limited space of time. So it's almost more dangerous, I think, because they're getting more screwed up and more drunk by 11 than they used to by 2. So they're not spreading it over a number of hours. I don't think that's a good argument at all. It's just stupid to have a curfew. A curfew is for countries that are ruled by the military or for children when their parents are trying to impose a rule on them. We are not children, and this has got to stop now. What purpose does it serve? Zero, none whatsoever. I'm sorry, doctors, I'm going to say this again. If part of your job as a doctor is treating people in trauma wards, in trauma units who have been involved in alcohol-related incidents, then that is what your job is as a doctor. You cannot make a rule for all of society just so that it makes it easier for doctors. And by the way, there's no evidence whatsoever that doctors have been overwhelmed, that our hospitals have had a very hard time, that we need to have this rule for eternity just to protect doctors. They're also ordinary people who have to work, and many of them have had nothing to do through coronavirus. Nothing. So let's stop with this nonsense, please.
I hate the fact that I agree with this person, but they seemed very nuts jobby.
Yeah.
It's a clip I saw over the weekend. I can't even remember where I saw it. But clearly someone who would be labeled a general conspiracy theorist, and he says, be aware of everything that is happening right now. You know, things like restrictions and curfew. Are you really free if there are restrictions and curfews? Then my eyes opened up a little and he says, this is all part of a greater plan. Look at you now, begging to get some injection from the powers that be. They needed this for the past year. They needed to suppress you and make you feel horrible about yourselves, because here you are lining up and begging for a vaccine that they are in control of. And I thought, yes, it is true, guys. It's all
true.
Part of the plan. Be careful. So,
meanwhile, I don't know if anybody's making a fuss of this, but this is quite a big story. And you would think that the activists in society who are super woke and are constantly telling us what's wrong with, like, America or South Africa or anywhere else, you'd think they'd have something to say about this, but this is how little Vladimir Putin gives a shit about woke people. New amendments in Russia mean that same-sex couples will not be able to legally marry, because Russia's constitution says marriage can only exist between a man and a woman. And they have banned transgender people from adopting children in Russia. So I wonder if we'll hear anything from all the people who scream and shout about transgender bathrooms when it comes to Russia, because of course it's easy to criticize a progressive, sensible Western country about how not woke enough they are, but countries like Russia or Saudi Arabia or countries where there are no such rules don't seem to be easy targets for these people, because they're not easy targets.
Many of these countries are on our own continent.
Correct. So can we please stop looking for the splinter in someone else's eye when there's a huge wooden beam in the eye of other countries? It's madness.
But also, I can't take Russia seriously when, once again, they collectively voted, which is not the case, that Vladimir Putin is the sexiest man once again.
But
okay,
why don't you believe that, Sia? Of course he is. What's wrong with you?
Sure.
You don't believe?
They say they polled more than 2,000 people and they all voted that he, hands down, once again, is the sexiest man in Russia.
Have you not
what
seen him?
What a load of crap!
Have you not seen him hunting and riding horses and shooting bears? And I mean, of course he is.
Those photographs
are
so old.
They still use that.
Yeah, he needs to update his profile with more fishing pictures and things, because I bet you he doesn't look like that anymore. And besides, when he did look like that, he still wasn't sexy.
Don't lie,
oh,
man.
Please.
You got,
he's
I've
not attractive in the least.
You've got a massive picture of him up on your wall at home. I've seen it before. Stop
yeah,
with the lies.
Above my headboard.
Absolutely.
So he's 68 years old, and when asked who the most attractive man in the country was, 18% of men and 17% of women voted for Putin.
But that doesn't
but
sound
this
like
this was
a,
down.
Doesn't sound like a majority. 17% of women is not. It's a tiny, tiny minority, but he's still the sexiest man in Russia. 68, huh?
Yeah.
Vladimir's 68.
But this was down by, 68 years old, but this was down by 1% in each group compared to the previous year. Russians still call Vladimir Putin the most attractive of the famous men in the country.
Wow.
In this field, neither actors nor athletes nor other politicians can compete with him today.
That's pretty awesome. Okay. I didn't realize he was 68 years old. He's looking good for 68. I mean, he might not be the sexiest man in the world, but give him credit, right?
And when it comes to those photos that you were speaking of, Leanne, when he's shirtless and whatnot, he insisted back in 2018 that he was not embarrassed about the topless snaps and said he saw no need to hide behind the bushes while on vacation, riding on horseback or fishing.
I wonder how he'd feel if he knew that a gay person was looking at his picture.
Oh, he'd get very upset. And not you.
Then he'd feel differently.
You're not allowed to look. You're homosexual. You cannot look.
I can live without some Putin in my life. Don't worry.
Really, Sia? You're just you. Everyone else needs him, but you can get away with it. Activists are too scared of Russia, says Harold. You're absolutely right. Anyone with a Russian accent is very sexy, says Andre. If you say so. The sexiest man in Russia is my son, Hunter. He flies in with tons of cash in a briefcase and passes out in his hotel room for days at a time. I think that's from Joe Biden, that message. Did you see any of this documentary, this interview that Hunter Biden did over the weekend? I don't know how this isn't more news. You know, we had to hear about how terrible Ivanka Trump is for 4 years. We heard what a disgusting human being this girl is. Someone who started her own business, someone who's happily married, is good mother to her children, at least for all intents and purposes, who's supportive of Jared Kushner, her husband. But we had to hear what terrible people these two are. I don't know how, where they pulled that from. I don't know what awful, evil stuff they've done. There seems to be no evidence of this. But this Hunter Biden, who is the president of the United States' son, has got his own, like, videos on the internet of him with hookers in flagrante delicto with huge amounts of cocaine.
It's a nightclub.
Yeah, it's a nightclub. Huge amounts of cocaine. The guy admits on TV that he was snorting so much cocaine that he was going over his carpets to try and find traces of it eventually, just because he desperately needed a hit. And, you know, he would like snort Parmesan cheese because he thought it was cocaine. Oh. You know, the guy's he's like such a mess. He threw a handgun away outside a gun shop right near a school into the rubbish bin. How just completely out of control. Now, how is Hunter Biden not being reviled by the press the way that Ivanka Trump was? And what did Ivanka Trump ever do? Nothing. She did nothing horrible in her life that I could possibly find. This guy lives like this. He does an interview. He's apparently published a book about his life story. He's been bailed out by his father, I don't know, a million times. And he's somehow the better guy, and Trump's children are terrible. Someone explain that to me, please. I'd love to hear your explanation.
Yeah, I've missed all of that hub and the bug. I haven't heard much about it. I just heard there was some investigations to his laptop to see what was on there and to corroborate all of this. But yeah, it's clearly not as much of a big deal.
Yeah, so clearly the media is biased.
Yeah, if you needed any more evidence, and forget about political stuff because you're never going to find the evidence there, and they'll always say, oh, no, we've got to look at both sides of the story or whatever. Just compare Hunter Biden and coverage over him and all of the things that he's done, some of which may have even been national security problems, and compare that to Ivanka and Jared and tell me who got the soft touch from the media. I'd really like to see someone talk their way out of that one. Orange man bad.
When, as opposed to, you know, the story that I heard about the U.S. over the weekend was regarding a supposed comment that former President Trump made while at Mar-a-Lago over this weekend, and no one can confirm it. There's no clip. There's nothing. But that is now something that I'm seeing gaining momentum. Supposedly, he said because of everything that he did for COVID-19, that the vaccine should instead be called the Trump scene. And I'm like, why are people running with this when, as well, there isn't the evidence? But it's very easy to point out you know, make villains out of people and also heroes.
I can't imagine. You know, for the media, there are lots of reasons why Trump has to stay in the news, because for them, he's clickbait. But, you know, he's been depersoned. I mean, you can't even interview Donald Trump. If we wanted to put him on here, we wouldn't be able to promote it on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. Like, they're not allowing anyone. It's almost as if they are now, there's a moratorium on Donald Trump on the internet, which is bizarre. This is not, you know, the leader of Al-Qaeda we're talking about, who's trying to recruit people into terror cells. This is the former president of the United States. The fact that he doesn't exist on social media at the moment, he's been scrubbed off of social media, should worry everybody. If that isn't being controlled, I don't know what is. And
but then why are we not seeing any interviews at all, whether they're on social media or not?
Because they've decided that Donald Trump is not a person anymore. They've memory hold him. He's gone. And meanwhile,
who has? Social media,
the owners of these people who run these corporations in Silicon Valley, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey, these people are not.
But then why aren't independent TV channels or magazines, if we want to resort to print even, independent websites featuring interviews with him?
Well, because there's such pressure on them to not have him on, that they'll be shut down by woke people if they do have him on. And the only ones that are brave enough to do it are people like, I suppose, Fox News, because, you know, they're as partisan on the right as MSNBC is on the left. Mm. But it's amazing. Like, that will get you memory hold, Donald Trump, for saying a couple of things off color on social media. And they keep saying, oh, well, he made this riot on January the 6th or whenever it was happened. He did not. I mean, if you listen to the speech that he made on that day, he didn't. So they've used as an excuse to shut him down completely. What I find even more disturbing is that we talk about Black Lives Matter and that movement as if it's some kind of good movement. Turns out the founder of BLM has racked up $1 million property empire. This woman now has 4 homes that she's bought all over the United States. This is the founder of Black Lives Matter. Sounds like she's really doing a lot for, you know, black people being killed by the cops. She's bought 4 homes in the last couple of months with all the money that she's been taking from Black Lives Matter, that all these corporations have been pressured into giving.
Okay.
Her name is Patrice.
I was going to say, where is the money coming from? Is it the public or is it corporate?
No, it's corporate donations and members of the public who thought that they would be supporting Black Lives Matter, the movement. You know, they've taken in $90 million in donations in the last year. And her name is...
90.
Her name is Patrice Khan Cullors. She's 37 and she has just bought 4 new homes, currently valued at about $3.2 million in total. Don't tell me that isn't worthy of more than just a passing glance in the media. You don't see her being banned from Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Just madness. It really is just insane.
What times we are living in.
And, you know,
this is not the best thing to say after, you know, a year and some change of lockdown. But we really just, let's all close for business. No, let's close for renovation. Let's just, let's take some time to go. Let's not interact with other countries. Let's fix what we have. Let's just take 6-7 months. Figure ourselves out.
Yeah, well, apparently she bought her most expensive home, this is Jared says, in an all-white neighborhood. Hashtag BLM. Yeah, surprise, surprise.
But what's an all-white neighborhood? Don't make it sound like Orania.
Well, you know, it's like they moved the baseball out of Georgia because they say that Georgia's got these really horrible voting rules that they've brought in. So they've moved MLB, Major League Baseball, to Colorado, which apparently has even more strict rules around voting. But nobody thinks that's ironic. How bizarre. I want to talk to somebody who has been on the show before. He's a friend of ours. He's also an advertising guru. He's done an incredible amount of really interesting work in his life. But we're not going to talk about any of that today. We're going to talk about his book, which he's just written, and it's not his first either. He's been a very successful author for some time, and now he's written this. It's called You Never Really Know. His name is John Hunt. It's always good to see you, John. Nice to have you on the show this morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, sir. How are you?
Extremely well. I had a very nice lunch with John the other day because we decided, bugger this, we haven't done anything normal for a while. We were all in lockdown. John had some very important work to do there too while we were in lockdown. And he's been, apart from writing books, he's been trying to keep the country together and trying to make sure that advertising continues to advance in all the right directions. So you really haven't been slacking, huh? The last couple of months, you've been working harder than most of us.
Yeah, it's let's say COVID has its own rewards in terms of when you're trapped in front of a screen and everyone knows where you are. So you can't do this kind of, I'm in the car or I'm driving somewhere else. So time is well used, whether you like it or not.
So, John, I mean, was there pressure for you to write a book, or was it in you and you just couldn't wait to do it? Did the excuse of lockdown give you time to do it? Or is this something that was always going to happen with or without all the craziness we've been through?
Definitely no pressure except from myself. Yeah. And I felt the need to do it. So it's much easier when you feel you have to do something. Right. You know, if a third party is telling you what to do, then it doesn't work. But I really, really wanted to write this particular book in this particular time, and it's kind of strange because the book was written before COVID, mm-hmm. but then I edited it during this kind of weird last sort of 18 months. So it was something that was in me, and I'm very, very happy to say that so far it seems to be well received.
Well, I've only just started it, and It's novels are not something I usually read, but you write so beautifully, and your last book was really sort of autobiographical, even though it wasn't, because it was set in places that you'd grown up in and a Johannesburg that you know really well. This is a very different book in every way. It's the story really of a kid who grows up in this extraordinary environment where it's the president's private house, the president of this country, and he gets to have a front row seat to all kinds of history unfolding, but his own life is really messy. I mean, he's basically an orphan, and he grows up with access to all of this amazing stuff happening around him, but exactly the opposite of privilege in every other way. Was this inspired by anyone in particular, or is this totally the fruit of your imagination?
Well, there was a movie and a book which was called Stalin's Projectionist. And it was the whole, here was this guy who was just a projectionist, but he could hear, see, watch all that was going on with the then, the mighty Communist Party. And I always thought how cool it would be to be a fly on a wall where you sort of witness the mighty, but you're a nothing. So I created a character that is really the barista to the president in his unofficial residence. So he gets to see and hear anything, but of course he's a nobody, he's a shadow.
Yeah.
So I thought that would be, you get investigative journalism and then you get sort of, people who were married to powerful people, but to be one of those servants, to be kind of part of the entourage, but in a very, very distant way.
Yeah.
I thought it was a nice lens to watch, and I made up what I thought powerful people would be doing and saying, and some of it, of course, based on what, the world's been through in the last couple of years.
Listen, I've as I said to you, just started it, but it's terrific. So I'm very excited to get into the meat of this. And obviously, because it's you, it's always, there's always a twist in the tale. There's always these things that we think we can relate to, and then we're surprised by stuff. The actual process of writing, and you say it was written before coronavirus and before the lockdown. Is it for you a very easy process, or do you sit there and some days you get this infamous writer's block, or does it just flow?
Yeah, It depends. To be honest, I'm a slow writer, so I have to write often. So the only way I can do that is to get up every morning and do it. I would love the idea of sort of, you know, there's a sunset and you're drinking a nice bottle of wine and the muse comes and plays a harp for you and then it's fantastic and everything, but it doesn't work that way for me.
Don't ruin our vision of you, Mr. That's what we think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe it likes someone giving me a massage, yeah. You know.
Fanning you with palm leaves.
Exactly. But it's the exact opposite for me, unfortunately.
I heard an incredible story over the weekend. Someone told me that Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, one of the most famous books of the 20th century, apparently Harper Lee's friends actually got together and said, listen, you're so talented, and we would love you to write a book. And we are going to give you money for a year. You take a year off to write this book, and we don't want you to do anything except write the book. Your expenses will be covered by all of us, your friends, and go off and do this. And, of course, she went and wrote this masterpiece. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's – I mean, I have no reason to disbelieve it, and certainly my very rudimentary fact check seems to have delivered that it was true that this happened. Do you think it's harder for authors when they do have all the normal day-to-day real-life stuff to think about as distractions or to consider, you know, their responsibilities? You know, you've got a family, you've got an advertising agency to run, that kind of thing.
I think we should test it. I think the Gareth Cliff Show should give me money for a year and let's see what I do. You know, I'm very happy with that offer. Gareth, thank
Great
you so
point.
Much.
I'll be your assistant.
Look, I think different authors have different ways of working and different motivations. I think probably if it's too easy, it's a little bit for some people, it's what the hell do I fill my time with? Other people will always complain that they never have enough time to write. In the end, it's up to you. Some people write in little moments of half an hour and then they have to, you know, off to the office. 99% of people write squeezing it into the other part of their lives where they have to make stuff happen. So it's a commitment from a time point of view, and only the very, very, very wealthy or famous authors get to do it full time and at their own pleasure.
Yeah, and then we don't know if they're taking like 3 months and then just slacking completely and not even touching their work, you know. So, John, I noticed there's a surfboard in the background there. Is that yours?
Oh, yes. So there's a great little side story there. The chairman then of TBWA is a very famous guy called Lee Clough.
Yeah.
And back in the day, Lee would give an agency or person in one of the global agencies a national surfboard if they thought you'd had a really great year. So that's a surfboard made in L.A. by a very famous of course, very Californian. He's a surfboard artiste.
Yeah.
And each year or most years, Lee would choose a country that he thought the advertising was really good from that year and give them their surfboard. So there's surfboard from Lee. You know.
I love it. So speaking of advertising, I mean, what's been happening in the last couple of months and how things changed for you guys at TBWA? I know you've worked all over the world, and, you know, when you and Reg started Hunt Lascaris all those years ago, you had this dream of becoming this massive worldwide agency, and you've achieved that in bucket loads. But the advertising industry has changed enormously, and no more than now, or no less than now, should we say. What's been happening?
Yeah, look, I think it's really been interesting because in one way we've got a very clear, I wouldn't say wake-up call, but a very clear observation that working often from home and remotely has taken out, call it the middleman, or to be politically correct, the middle person. So there's efficiencies, you know, faster, quicker. You wouldn't get, you know, often I'd either be traveling to other countries or you're having all these meetings, that's gone. So from a purely efficiency point of view, lots of ticks in lots of boxes.
Yeah.
But if your business is built on a culture, I think we're beginning to see the first strains appearing where, you can work from your bedroom, or if you've got a nice home, even better. But there's, you know, we're human animals, we're social animals. And I think there is the beginning of, you know, we need to see each other. We need that coffee and crack a joke and meet people in the passageway. So I think the next few months is going to be, if the COVID protocols allow, how do you return to the new normal where you are still human beings and maybe even enjoying your drive into work for a change?
Sure.
Versus sort of isolated but very, you know, maybe efficient, or, you know, everyone works at least 8 hours.
Isn't it interesting though, and as somebody who's kind of in charge of seeing a lot of this change happen and managing it, it's amazing how some people like to be left alone at home, and they actually get more done than they might have done in the office. And then there are those people who, as you've indicated already, they like to be in the office. It's important for them. They need that stimulation. They need to feel part of something. And the two are so different.
Yeah. And it's not always, but it's a little generational. Younger seem to be a little more mobile and, hey, I'll work from the top of Table Mountain. I think it's a combination of both, and you can't force one, you know, on the other. You've got to be a little circumspect, and a lot of homes, it's interesting, flats are being built now, apartments are being built around the world with little acoustic booths, because that's, from now on, many, many people will be building, will be working from home. So it's really affecting, you know, stuff that we don't fully appreciate yet. But I still think there comes a time and a place where you need to bond a little bit, and let's find a new mix over the next couple of months and years.
Right. Well, I think we're all trying to figure it out, so no one really knows at this point. So, you know, if you feel like you're making mistakes, you're probably not the only one. Let's just go back to the book for a second. So you've written two other books. I mean, The Space Between was the first one that you wrote. And then The Boy Who Could Keep a Swan in His Head, which I mentioned briefly earlier. You know, this kid who grew up in Hillbrow in Johannesburg. Now, you Never Really Know is very different to these two books. Was it your intention to, because I suppose you could have written about anything. And the nice thing about writing fiction is that you can base it on a character, you can base it on a storyline. Where do you even begin with something like this? As someone who doesn't write, I'm fascinated in the process, with the process.
So everyone has their own process. For me, I kind of get the noodle of a story developing, and I can put, when I sit down, I've got the arc. You know, it's going to be the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Yeah.
Then when I start writing, that changes. But I have to have that sort of broad, so there's like a sort of security. Okay, this is going to be about, so for me, this was going to be about a barista. I like the idea. I love coffee, and I thought it's cool to have a barista. He was going to look in, get a bird's eye view of, not a bird's eye view, but a little fly on the wall view of power.
Right.
And he was going to not stay powerless somehow, whatever.
And he sees all the corruption, and he sees how the politicians deal with each other. But he himself, isn't his name also Cappuccino, which is so funny because it refers to like a mixed race heritage. And he part of the story is also, you know, he has to find out who his father was.
Correct.
This is very South African. I mean, I think a lot of people can relate to this stuff.
Yeah, that seems to be the feeling from people who kindly sent me, you know, little SMSs and contacted me, that it's the ultimate in their, you know, so it's a South African story. It talks about all this stuff that we're going through now, so it's very current. But it's not political grandstanding. It's not, as I say, investigative journalism. It's somewhere else. It allows me to have lots of fun. And if, you know, if I want to give the president a big nose, I can do that. If I want to, his assistant, Naomi, she's drop dead gorgeous. So it's not based on fact. It's just based on me having a lot of fun in what is happening in what appears to be happening, not just in South Africa, but around the world. You know, politics is a very weird place right now.
God.
So
absolutely.
It's not a political critique. It's me going, let's, you know, wow. Imagine if you were a barista and you were watching all this, you know. Mm.
Well,
dot, 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 dot.
I always like to check in with you because you seem to have a very level-headed approach to so many things. And we've been through such a tumultuous year. And obviously, writing books and reading books like this is a bit of escapism. But the reality is that we have had this incredible change and so much has happened. How are you feeling about not only South Africa but the world right now? You've always been a very positive guy and you've had a great optimistic outlook on life. How are you feeling about things? Do you think we're in a terrible position and, you know, all these people are running around saying that everything's negative and it's all falling apart? Or are you much more sanguine about things and, you know, no country's dealt with it better than any other one necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be negative, you can put up a lot of justifiable things. So that's always, you know, where a lot of people start. And you've got a tick box of a lot of negative things. I'm a bit of a born-again optimist kind of guy in that I always see things swinging. Yeah. So as it gets to one extreme, you sort of hold your breath and go, please, Lord, please. And then slowly things swing back. Not always at the speed you like. So I think the world is at quite an extreme moment, particularly through COVID, et cetera, and that's been pushed and pressurized. And that optimistic part of me goes, okay, so now you have to readdress. You've done so many stupid things or you behaved in, you know, such a selfish way. No, you know, let's see the pendulum start moving the other way. And I think that's what's happening now. So that's my my chirpy good morning piece of sort of my own propaganda. That's what I tell myself because
nice.
I think people inherently are good.
We need to.
I think we
go on.
No, I just think people. You know, there are a lot of schmucks and terrible people in the world, but there are also a lot of wonderful people who just go about their business every day.
Yeah. Well, I've got to tell you, I'm always impressed that you have the creative output that you do. The book is called You Never Really Know. It's John Hunt's latest work and is available at good bookstores and online, obviously, too. Have they forced you to do an audiobook version yet, John? Because you could narrate this beautifully.
No, but I think that's in the mix. And as you know, audio around the world is just growing lickety-split. So in many parts of the world now, that almost starts off with audio. You know, you do the audio first, and then off you go. So, and a quick aside, I was in Franschhoek last year, and a guy tapped me on the shoulder, Malcolm Gooding, might remember, he was a famous voiceover, and he told me how many of our South African voiceover artists from the old days in radio are now employed overseas doing wonderful readings of various famous authors' books.
Fantastic.
So, see, positiveness everywhere.
You just got to find it. John, well done on the book. It's always good to see you, and thanks for keeping the rest of us sane and optimistic. It's important. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Always good. There's John Hunt, everybody. Lovely, lovely stuff. His new book is called You Never Really Know. And as someone who doesn't read a lot of fiction, I'm getting into this. It's really good.
Mm.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you really, really never really know.
No.
He seems like the type of guy who you could go to with a really hard question, like how do you feel about South Africa at the moment? And that he would just be unbiased and give a gentle opinion, yet it's strong in a different way. Like his writing in this book, it's a gentle poke or a gentle cynical look at what's going on politically, but it's not like full on critique.
Yeah, I mean,
what a beautiful analysis, Leanne.
Who doesn't like a good story, right? You know, we need good stories. I've started watching Vikings again because we did an episode of Blind History on the Vikings. And by the way, I've got to mention that we are starting this week is the week for the new season of Blind History. And we're going to hit the road running with some really good people who, and we've had some great suggestions from fans of Blind History of who they want us to feature in our next episodes. So we're already well into season 5 of Blind History.
You should do an episode on blondes in history, and then at least the people who say blonde history.
Blonde.
You know, we'd get it right. Blonde history.
That's so funny. We did an episode on the Vikings, though, and as part of that, I kind of got stuck into that series again. So I've started from scratch, first episode, first season, and I know I've got so much to still get through, which is cool. So I've also found at the same time I'm filling up my entertainment quota with good stories, even if they are. And so much of history is just mythology and legend, and you really have to separate the fact from the fiction. If you're watching a TV show like that, you don't have to separate anything. You just live into the, you know, those people's stories.
A little random, and take it with a pinch of salt. I don't think it applies to you at all, Gareth. But there was an article that I read a few weeks ago that stated, if you are someone who loves to rewatch series, mm-hmm. it might be because of a very mild level of anxiety that you're nursing and that you might not even be aware of, because there's something comfortable about rewatching series that you will not be surprised or taken by plot twists or whatnot. You know exactly what to expect.
Okay.
So it might be like not a red flag, but a yellow flag. I'm like, well, I rewatch series all the time.
It's so true, though. It's like the other day I was sitting with my family and my mom was flicking through the channels, and we caught a wildlife documentary just at the saddest part.
This
buffalo had been warding off a pride of lions for hours by himself, and his cronies had left him. And finally they got him, and the slow death. Oh my God, did I cry? Because it's just the world is a bit difficult at the moment, and I'd rather like something. I know it's predictable that the lions will get the buffalo, but I don't need to watch it. Show me Friends, you know?
Sorry.
I totally get that. Those documentaries are unnecessarily dramatic. You know, they know how to bait you. They know how to – they give the buck or something a name, and then you know which, you know, group or tribe or, you know, that buck comes from. And then they go, well, Henry's putting up quite a fight. You go, fight, Henry, fight. You can do it. But, well, Henry's going to end up on the dinner table for this pride of lions.
After hours and hours,
yes.
Henry falls slowly. To his death, drained of blood.
Oh.
As his son, Derek, watches on.
Yes! Oh, no.
From the thicket.
It's amazing, though.
Did you have this tiny little bug? No. So, horrible.
You know, I suppose one of the things that I like about rewatching old series is, and there are only a few that I've watched, you know, more than once, because most of these series, you get your fill out of. And then they usually go on too long anyway. You know, like I fell off the, what was that zombie thing? The Walking Dead. There was an episode at the beginning of one of the seasons or at the end of one of them where I was like, no, this is enough already. It's like super violent and it was just ugly. And I was like, okay, I'm zombied out. I don't need to go back to The Walking Dead ever again.
Yeah.
And I walked out of The Walking Dead, and that was it. Mm-hmm. I was done with that one. And then, you know, there's some that I could watch over and over again. There's this brilliant, brilliant HBO series called Rome, which is now probably, I don't know, 15 years old. But it was just two series. Absolutely beautifully done. Great actors, great costume and set design, historical authenticity. And every single time I watch those shows, it feels like I'm learning something new. It's just so good. So I think you've got to find the ones that work for you, and then there's nothing wrong with going back to them. I'm excited about Vikings, and then I've got to go back and pick up, because I watched it, and I know it keeps winning awards, but Schitt's Creek is like it's just so funny, and I do think I've got to get back into that at some point, because I also watched I think maybe the first or the second season, and then I also just kind of lost interest. But if I go back to it now, I might be able to pick up where I left off.
Yeah, I'd like to watch it again from the start. I've finished it a few months ago. Yeah.
But aren't they...
We haven't...
They're not making any more, right? It's done.
No,
it's done.
It's done.
But with all of these things, it's up until how much money they're offered again and for some spin-off or a movie.
Yeah. I'd love that, though.
What happened to the Friends reunion? Has it aired yet?
Ugh. Would you be excited about that? I really don't care.
No, when was it meant to...
Generation Z is very excited about it.
There was meant to be a big reunion episode, and there was a... Okay.
I think they took the money. They just took the money and ran.
I just never know if it's already happened or not because, you know, everything's delayed here, which I still don't understand, but anyway.
Oh, okay. Oh, geez, they still haven't filmed it.
No. See, they're lazy. And they've taken the money, guaranteed.
Oh, well, we know that everyone Jennifer Aniston has already used it.
Yeah, but Jennifer Aniston's probably the most successful of all of them, right? I mean, the others have not done as well as she has. None of them have been a complete disaster, but I think she was the one who's had the most incredible movie career out of all of them. Who's the biggest loser friend of all of them? What are they all doing?
In terms of right now and their current wealth?
I mean, David Schwimmer, he produces movies and he's been in a couple of movies and TV shows.
He's in a new series as well.
Joey, Matt LeBlanc, he's doing like the Top Gear in the UK and he's done some other stuff as well. He had his own spin-off series, remember, straight after Friends as well. So he's okay. I suppose like Chandler, what was it, Matthew...
Perry.
He didn't do so well. And didn't he get really fat as well? And then...
He battled substance abuse issues for a while.
Okay, and then Phoebe, whatever happened to her? Lisa Kudrow?
She still appears in quite a few fun movies and even serious ones. And I think there's one with her... in a political series at the moment where she's got quite a serious role, I think, I remember seeing.
And what about Courtney Cox?
She produces a lot of stuff.
Courtney Cox did that series in Miami, wasn't it? Florida. It was a comedy thing.
Doesn't sound...
It was very successful. It was very successful at the time, and it was quite fun. It's over.
No, well, she also signed quite an impressive deal with Facebook to, I think they're into their second or their third season now. It's a documentary style series around pregnancy and about what different couples go through when it comes to pregnancy. So, yeah, she's good. Look, none of them have really been slouches. Perhaps the slouchiest of them is, what is the dude who worked at the coffee shop called? Who never said anything but was a character?
Yeah. He was
at Central Perk.
Yeah. I must tell you, I don't think I could get back into Friends. I think that was also... That's one of those shows that's just very much a time capsule for, the late 90s. I don't know that I'd ever want to go back there or that I'd be able to understand it the way that I used to. Because you almost felt like, you know, in those days, it was good and then you have to save the game and put it away. Some stuff you don't want to go back to. Some stuff is just, it's good the way that you remember it.
The thing is, the writing of that is really still so good. So the reason I know is not because I sit down and watch it willingly, but my mom and dad have got into it. And, you know, if my mom's sitting at home, she has it on. It runs all the time on Comedy Central. And having it in the background, you just catch bits of it. You don't need to sit and watch it and drop everything. Just having it on in the background, you pick up on little bits and test your memory, and you'll be like, oh, I remember that. I remember when Rachel made a Christmas trifle and – she started with the layers of dessert, and it was custard and cream and fruit. And she turned over the page, but the two pages had got stuck together. And the next one was a savory casserole dish. So her next layers were mince and rice and potatoes and gravy. You know, it's just good writing and relaxing and fun.
Okay, that is smart.
So here's reminding the official word from HBO Max and the Friends team. They were meant to film this reunion special in March of 2020. We know what happened then, and all projects were put on pause for a while. Then as of November 2020, Matthew Perry and the team confirmed that they'll start filming, and they've rescheduled filming for March of 2021. So they haven't even actually filmed anything as of yet, and we're in April, so who knows when we're going to see it.
Leanne, compliment for you quickly. We were talking about audiobooks earlier with John. Jenny says that she reckons you would be great for audiobooks, your voice. But then you kind of have, haven't you done some of those already?
I haven't done any fictional audiobooks. I've only done sort of study guides and that sort of thing.
All right.
But it's definitely something I would love to do.
Yeah.
I would love to. So I'll investigate that. Thank you for the suggestion. The one thing that we haven't spoken about is, and we did promise, is what age you're happiest at.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, we can't leave that out. Before we finish the show, let's do it. Let's do that. That's important.
Okay, it's because we're unhappy, Leanne.
Yeah, tell us. Come on, let's hear it.
So they do these every now and then. And I think now, especially now that the whole world isn't the same, things have changed a lot. But according to this study by researchers that I came across, is a lot of people think it's like going to be somewhere in your 20s.
Yeah.
But this is the age of 36. That's what they're saying.
Now, that's interesting, because Thea was saying earlier he thought it would be like kids, because kids are carefree and they, you know, everything's looked after for them. They don't worry about tax or house maintenance or having to raise their own children. Kids are like totally carefree. But it's not that. It's not your teens, because your teens obviously are filled with anxiety and nervousness and peer pressure and all of that shit. I kind of agree. 36, you say?
Yeah. And they say it's quite interesting, because at that stage, you're probably going through the most tumultuous time of your life, either getting married or down the line in your marriage, or getting divorced, having children, changing jobs, experiencing some deaths and things like that that you hadn't experienced so much in your 20s, death of friends and families. And so even though you're dealing with all of this, you feel like you've got the experience of having 10 years to deal with in your 20s to get yourself ready for this.
Wow.
You kind of know who you are. And they actually have like a phrase for the ages of 30 to 45 called established adulthood. When you've figured out who you are, and even though you're dealing with all of these mental and cognitive issues, you feel quite alive, and in the present and living.
All right, so
people have goals.
So in other words, I mean, if you're somewhere around 36, then be happy, because that's not a bad place to be. That's the best time to kind of take stock of your life and to enjoy what you are and who you are and where you are. Nice. I like it. I wouldn't have guessed that ordinarily. And I think obviously beyond 36, you will also start to feel older. So that would start to diminish your happiness in time. But that's a lot older than I thought it would be.
Yeah, the one interviewee.
What's that say?
Sorry, the one interviewee says he's age 36. He says it's a sigh of relief after the tumultuous 20s. Things feel more in place. I've put together a machine that's finally got all the parts it needs.
Wow. It reminds me of a stand-up special that I watched by Leslie Jones, and she's an actress, comedian, and she's on Saturday Night Live. She goes, you know, the 30s are the time to make important decisions. After your 20s, you need to realize and decide in your 30s, are you going to keep being a hoe, or you're going to stop being a hoe. This is the time. 20s, you were still just experimenting. 30s, are you going to keep that up and carry on being a hoe? Are you now going to, in your 30s, be committed to community service and helping society, or are you going to continue to servicing the community? Just okay, I get it.
All right, well, that's all we got time for today, unfortunately, but we were action-packed this morning, and we will be tomorrow too, so we will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m., bright and early. Have an awesome day. CliffCentral.com